And all right, now we're going. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're here to prove that the sun has risen and is no longer in the grave and never was. And, you know, what we're here for is to learn and study what we can about how to rise ourselves. And so we're reading through Gary Renard's most recent book. I'm looking at your face here, which is The Lifetimes Where Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other. And right now we're talking about a lifetime where they are with they have just come through Plato's Academy. And so their names are Ikaros and Takis. And it is very interesting read so far, and I'm enjoying it tremendously. It's great to have these glimpses into, you know, what may have happened. What part of the illusion did Jesus and Buddha walk through, and how they got from there to here, sort of like the Lord of the Rings. Anyway. Anyway, Bruce, would you like to start reading? I think we are.
Sure.
I have Mark, so I think we're in the right place. So
yeah, had us on page 60, at the top of page 60.
Yeah.
But maybe we could back up a couple of paragraphs. Should I start in on the bottom of page 59, just a couple of those paragraphs?
Yeah, just for context, I think it'd be great.
Okay. I'm going to start where Gary says, so Plato was non-dualistic? Persis says, no. You'll see that mentioned in this brief exchange between Takis and Ikaros after having a class with Plato. Gary, there were J and B in that lifetime? Persa, yes. No need to go into details of how they knew each other. Just like schools of fish swim together in the ocean, people travel together in different dream lifetimes. They are destined to come into contact with each other over and over. Here's a little of what they said. Of course, this is a
And I just want to point out, it actually does say that in A Course in Miracles. That is actually something that is said in the Manual for Teachers. So we know that that's true.
That we are destined to meet, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think and how could I'm going to paraphrase Richard Bach first from I believe it's Jonathan Siegel, actually. Jonathan Livingston Siegel. Where he says, in the middle of here and now, don't you think we might, you know, he said something like, I think he said something in there that I remember, because I read that book a bunch of times when I was in my early metaphysical studies, long before I read the course, and he says something to the effect of, abolish time and all you have left is now, abolish space and all you have left is here, and in the middle of here and now, don't you think we might see each other once in a while or something, once or twice, something like that. So, which is kind of, you know, a nice introduction to the idea that in pure non-duality, how could there be anything vaguely hinting at loneliness if everything is included in perfect oneness, right? I mean, it sort of puts the kibosh on any, not only the belief in separation, but certainly any aloofness or distance or or feeling of isolation or abandonment, or, you know, all that stuff is just, you know, insanely irrelevant in perfect oneness, which is what this curriculum is leading us toward. Of course, we can't really grok that from where we think we are right now, but I think it's reassuring to remember, and we have feelings of tremendous peacefulness when we allow ourselves to take the course's real logic and extrapolate that to what the implications are, is that, you know, there's no possible way that anyone we've ever loved or who has loved us could possibly be missing from that perfect oneness, including, you know, all of what we think of as creation in this world, but certainly, you know, the reality behind all the appearances, which of course is what Plato was talking about, is that, the metaphor was, I think that I remember something of the effect of, in Plato's doctrine was, you know, that an instance of a table is just a representation of the idea of a table. And I think a lot of that has pervaded Western thought. It certainly in the realm that I went into in terms of my career in this lifetime, computer programming, you know, you have instances of things, and that the whole object-oriented programming environment arose from that kind of ability to generalize and to abstract things. And, you know, so much of our technology is based on that, the idea that you can make a general tool that can be repurposed is really sort of like a knockoff of the original idea that what we really are is one thing, and we're just, you know, replicating or appearing to divide that. But behind all the apparent multiple instances of things is really the one idea. And I think that's, you know, what even though the instances can seem to be different, it's the sameness that really leads us back to the oneness. And I think that's a hugely important idea in A Course in Miracles. And we get to the sameness by looking at shared interests, looking at particularly our unkind thoughts, which are the barriers to the sameness, and then, you know, trusting our inner kindness teacher to say, okay, if I'm not being kind, then I must be resisting the oneness. I must be resisting the perfect love that's behind that. So anyway, enough of that digression.
and you're absolutely right there. And here's a thing that I'm sure that it just escapes everybody. I'm sure this idea escapes everybody. But mighty companions, everybody is our mighty companion.
Yeah.
Every human that you meet in common contact with, the homeless person on the street, the president of the United States, you know, these are all people that are our equal sons of God who we are given a choice every moment to accept and love or to reject and turn away from. And it's our own decision to reject and turn away that causes the loneliness, causes the sense of isolation, the sense of despair. It's my decision to reject my brother that puts me in a place where I feel that way. And it's the only way out of it is to accept and to love unconditionally without judgment. And, yeah. You know, that's really Jesus' challenge. He's not challenging us to be kind to ourselves or to be loving to the ones we love. He's saying reject no one, reject nothing. Right. Everyone is the Holy Son of God, just as you are, and your thoughts and opinions about them are irrelevant. And so, excuse me. It's coming to the point where, you know, where I can, you know, accept without rejecting. You know, that doesn't mean I'm actively loving right now, because, you know, actively loving is something that is, that takes an openness in the heart to do. And, the heart never opens unless you are willing to, be vulnerable and to be open to these people and to not defend yourself from them and not be afraid of them, because it's the fear that brings about the rejection. And it's the rejection that brings about the sense of despair and loneliness. So, you know, my favorite lesson, as everyone knows well, lesson 181, I trust my brothers who are one with me. Until I can come to that point where I can trust my brothers who are one with me, then I am going to be in fear, and I will not have that sense of connection. So, you know, it's hard to understand, because, you know, we feel so much we have to protect ourselves, but there is nothing to protect ourselves from. If I defend myself, I am attacked.
Exactly.
That's the logical truth of it. Anyway, so I'll stop talking, and it just is an important thing to me right now.
Yeah,
the understanding of that.
It really is, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because it really is important to as Ken Wapnick would say, until we generalize to include everyone, whoever we leave out basically is our resistance. You know. A demonstration of our resistance to the peace and the loving kindness that we really want, because we don't think on some unconscious level we deserve it. But it's easy, I think, to indulge or engage in a level of confusion, to think that, you know, what the Course is saying is, oh, you know, don't lock your car or your door or your house, or don't have insurance, or you know, don't take vitamins, don't use a password on your online bank accounts or other online accounts. It's not that suggesting that at all. It's just basically saying that if I in my mind, it's never about behavior. It's never about form. So all those things are independent variables. But the one variable that is being asked of us is in the mind, in our assessment of what we have projected, which appears to be these other people on this planet and the other animals and minerals and vegetables and circumstances and situations, all the things that seem to be outside of us, those then on the level of the mind become our classroom for forgiveness and for integration by recognizing where we've held, grievances in our mind that have kept them separate in terms of our identity. And it's that identity that the Course is concerned about, not the behavior or the form. So anyway, I think that's always important to keep in mind because it's so easy to get into that level of confusion thing, isn't it? I mean, it's just, kind of an automatic, strategy of the ego to say, well, as long as I, do all these things in the level of form, then my peace is assured, which is the whole point of today's workbook lesson of, about the, pushing fluids through a sharpened needle into your, circulatory system or little metal discs or stacks of paper that's going to, stave off decay and death and, all that stuff. It's like, no, it's not about that. It's, do the normal things and be, be normal, as Ken suggested. But it's remembering that if we can do those with a gentle inner smile and recognize that none of those have had any impact on our real being, our real capital S self that is eternal, immortal, and not subject to time and space, outside of time and space, greater than the entire cosmology that we believe occupies time and space, then that's what we're trying to return to, is that awareness of that eternal, innocent, loving, beyond our imagination, wonderful being that we all are. So anyway, see, we haven't read very far, but we've had some good conversations already, huh?
We've had good conversation already. That's what this is all about, honestly.
Yeah.
What our observations are on these things. And today's lesson is a real doozy. I just got off a call with Marie McDonald. Anyway, talking about the lesson and, the lessons I'm under no laws but God's really is like totally informative to everything that you do in your life, because how many laws do you think you're under? I'm under the don't step on a crack, I'll break my mother's back law. I'm under the law of, Mercury is going retrograde in a few days. We'll have to worry about that. I'm under a lot of laws that aren't God's laws at all. And I follow them and I do whatever it is they tell me to do, hoping for better luck, hoping for a better situation, hoping that, things are going to go okay. When Jesus tells me in the Course in Miracles, first off, the script is written. You ain't changing none of it. And uh-huh. Second of all,
it's a dream script.
nothing can harm a son of God.
Exactly. This is not your real script. This is a dream script we're talking about here.
Yes. Exactly. So
great points, Lynn. Yeah, excellent.
Yeah. So anyway, let's continue to read. So Gary or they're talking about Takis and Kairos. And go ahead and continue reading.
Okay. I just had, since we all seem to riff off each other so wonderfully, I just had one more thought because I was reading today's workbook lesson earlier this morning, and I'm under no laws but God's, and I was thinking about, and what you just said triggered a reminder. It's like, well, yeah, all the superstitions and rituals and things that, in our logical minds we say, oh yeah, that's silly. And even then, we tend to do a lot of those and not realize it, that are just totally arbitrary. Like, oh, I'll pick some numbers that I like for my phone number when I'm getting a new phone, or I'll go down, this street rather than that street because I think it's nicer, or just stuff that's really arbitrary, when things are kind of more superstition oriented, and we can laugh at that, sometimes not with but at in other people's superstitions, but not our own. And then some of the sneakier ones, though, you know, are the ones that take more discipline, let's say, that, you know, more practice to observe and then forgive ourselves for and let ourselves off the hook for and everyone else, is the ones where we are, you know, we bow down and make, you know, great sacrifices to the gods of science, you know, the laws of chemistry, the laws of physics, the laws of biochemistry, the laws of genetics, the laws of you know, decay and the laws of the technological laws, you know, of semiconductor physics. I remember taking a class in that in college and barely passing because of the ride through the campus in the rain to get to the class on the other side of the campus, and then throwing down my rain gear, hoping to find a seat in the back of the class, this huge lecture hall, and squinting to read the tiny writing that the lecturer had on the classroom board, which was not easy subject to begin with, and I was so glad I got a C minus in that class. The laws of semiconductor physics, you know, we think that that's why we're able to talk on the technology we're talking on, you know. Isn't it amazing all the things that we think we're subject to? But the point of it is not to go into all these details for no reason, but to recognize how much we've bought into this world as the real deal, and because these laws seem consistent in many cases and you know, very elaborate, we think, well, they must be the real deal. This must be the real reality because, wow, there's all these, you know, scientific and technical and papers and conferences and you know, written on all this stuff and research that's done around the world and people coming together internationally to you know, reinforce these laws about different subjects and principles and best practices and you know, I deal with all that stuff all the time, but and I'm sure you do too in different ways, but just to remember, it's like none of that has to do with the reality that's beyond the dream of space, time, and everything in it. And if we can just kind of keep that in our mind more and more often during the day, I think that really does help us, you know, kind of get back on track on our forgiveness classroom. And we can do, you know, two things at once. We can actually do the stuff that we do in our everyday lives, but do it in a more mindful way that is more gentle and more embracing of everyone as part of ourselves and more fun. So anyway.
Exactly. And less worried because, yes. The minute I start saying, well, that's not true. Well, that's not true. Well, that's not true. You know, when I start recognizing, hey, you know, I'm making up an incredible story about what, you know, I think is happening here. And when I see the truth and reality of it, you know, I recognize that, oh, that's just a story I made up about this and a story I made up about that. And I was the one who made those stories make sense. See, you mentioned something in that last, what you were saying is, you know, well, it seems to make sense or they seem to all come together. That's because we made them up and we make them come together.
Uh-huh.
It's all, we string it together and we say, well, that logically makes sense. And this should be here. And that should be there. We're the ones who are making it make sense to us. And, you know, then you see the insanity.
Yeah. And one of Ken Wapnick's talks, he says something to the effect of, you know, the Holy Spirit is brilliant, but so is the ego. And both thought systems are completely 100% consistent. It's just that one of them happens to be 100% insane, and that's the ego thought system. Because, you know, with all those consistencies of, you know, physics, science, you know, biology, all that stuff that we could, you know, go down all these little rabbit holes in of and finding all these things that seem to corroborate each other and to validate and to confirm, you know, this Matrix dream that, you know, is in this dystopian film. I'm hearkening back a few days to my wife and I watched the sequel to Blade Runner, which is Blade Runner 2049, I think is the title. And, you know, it's another film noir of this dystopian future, you know, where now the old replicants, you know, robots, you know, have been superseded by a newer, better breed of replicants, and now the new replicants are killing, like, without too much spoiler alert, they're trying to off all the older ones, and yet there's still a few humans that are still around, of which Harrison Ford's character is one of them. Anyways, but I was just watching the dialogue in this movie and realizing, wow, there's a lot of metaphysics here that's being shared that just probably goes, you know, right through people that aren't looking for it, you know, but I was just kind of like, wow, there's a lot of stuff here that they were saying in the dialogue that, you know, not that I recommend the movie generally if you have any kind of aversion to dystopian noir futuristic films, but it was really fascinating, you know, some of the things they were talking about, how, you know, we're just kind of putting it out there, the ego's insanity, you know, of how, I should have written some of them down, but there's some real zingers in there that they were just like, wow, you know, that's, if we just listen to the ego self-talk, the insanity of the zombie android robotic self that just is hell-bent on, you know, annihilation and violence, even though it doesn't occur to us that our the most subtle grievance or irritation is no different than blowing away, you know, a robot or another person or a whole galaxy, you know. It's really kind of amazing to just watch the contents of our mind and see how insane the ego is and how everything truly that relates to time and space, if it's disconnected from that inner kindness teacher, it's got to be insane. But the beauty of this curriculum is that we have every moment, every person, everything, every circumstance, every instant becomes our savior and our salvation by handing it over, the interpretation that is, to our inner kindness teacher, to Holy Spirit, to say, you know, look at this with me, because I'm going to misinterpret this. I'm going to think that I'm the subject and at the mercy of the laws of physics and economics and social norms and yada yada, you know, the list goes on and on. But in truth, what we really are is this incredibly magnificent, beautiful, peaceful, loving, innocent, one undivided capital S self that transcends anything that can exist in the dream of space-time. Huh? Anyway, another ramble. Why don't I actually read?
The rambles make a ton of sense. And, you know, it seems like the way this illusion is made, that it all sticks together so well. But, you know, when you look at the various parts, you recognize that they are just parts and pieces that, you know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle that all the pieces are the same shape.
Uh-huh.
And so you can put it together any way you want to, and it's going to go together because all the pieces are the same shape. But the reality of it is that unless they're in the right place, they make no sense whatsoever. And so, you know, but we look at it and we think they're in the right place. We look at physics and we think, oh, that's all in the right place. Everything is explaining everything the way it should be. We look at chemistry. We look at the periodic table and say, oh, there's spaces where things are missing. I'm sure we will find those chemicals at some point that, you know, we'll fill in those empty spots on the periodic table. You know, this is how we go about trying to make this world of form make sense. But it doesn't make sense. All of the pieces are the same. So they all fit anywhere you happen to put them. And when you put them there, it seems like it's the right place because you made it up.
Exactly.
You made it in that shape.
our minds are incredibly powerful. It's just that we've chosen an insane architect to write, you know, a playwright to whatever metaphor you like to craft or write the script and populate the stage with all these characters that seem, then they're within the, you know, as Ken pointed out, you know, within the dream, within the insane, you know, madhouse of the ego script, it seems perfectly consistent, but it's just consistent with insanity, which is the, you know, the dog eat dog, film noir, dystopian future, which is really in the past, that seems to be our script. But we don't, we have, you know, part of the ego strategy, I think, is to have little bursts, kind of like, you know, flowers in the desert, you know, that seem to make it, you know, livable now and then. And we go long periods of, you know, through long periods of dry spells of, you know, crawling on hands and knees through the desert until we reach the next little flower or the next little oasis that, you know, may sustain us until it's time to move on and we've depleted that. But, you know, if we can really see that the entire thing is this one massive, desolate, dystopian, egoic dream, and not condemn it, but just see it for the nothingness that it is, then, you know, we can, you know, say, hey, you know, I'm ready for the real alternative here.
Exactly.
And it's a gradual process. Yeah. If we saw it all at once, we'd go, you know, screaming mad out of the room or out of wherever we think we are. But that's why, you know, this curriculum is such a gradual, gentle, beautiful process. Is we just, you know, are asked over and over again by repetition to look at and forgive our choices for the ego, and in a very gentle, compassionate way, and simultaneously letting everyone else off the hook.
That's right. That's it. Exactly. well stated.
Shall I finally go on? Or?
Yes, finally, let's go on.
Okay, I'll read another couple paragraphs here. Now here's Takas, one of Jesus and Buddha's past lives. I can't remember which was. It doesn't matter anyway. Takas. Plato has a dilemma. In his philosophy, all things come from the good, and all the objects in the material universe are symbolic of an idea. So, like with the cave, the images the prisoners are seeing are symbols or shadows of something else. They're not real. But here's the dilemma. Coming from the good, Plato can't figure out why the good would make something that isn't real, and he ends up compromising. He's come to the conclusion that the things he's seeing are not real, but that the ideas behind them are. And he still has ended up with dualism because he has the source making illusions. If the source is interacting with something else, that's dualism. Ikaros, you're right. Plato is a brilliant philosopher, but the truth is that the symbols we're seeing are not real, and neither are the ideas behind them. They're coming from an illusory, seemingly separate mind. And this mind is not the source of real life, only an imitation of life. Exactly. So the ego's, the whole dream drama is a substitute. It's basically, you know, a shabby alternative, you know, a knockoff, that is not even real Naugahyde. It's artificial Naugahyde, right? it's basically, you know, just a made up, replacement for something that is so wonderful we can't even imagine how profoundly peaceful and tranquil our mind will be when we finally give up our attempts to, you know, make the substitute work for us, make this the dream of space-time and everything in it you know, fulfill us, from like it's something outside us going to do something for the inside of our mind, which ain't going to happen once we are honest with ourselves, right? Do you want to read that?
Sure. Excuse me. Excuse me. I just started coughing. All right. So yeah, I'll continue reading. So Artin says, Plato's Academy allowed for great intellects to come together and discuss ideas. Our two friends, with the cumulative experiences they had before, were able to learn from Plato, yet think for themselves. They showed nothing but respect for Plato in the discussions that took place in class, but in private they came to another conclusion, something that would come back to them and influence their final two lifetimes. So it's interesting to me that they have different ideas than Plato, but they're not going to Plato and saying, hey, here's where I think you're wrong. Anyway, so Ikaros says, this life is a hoax. It's all a distraction to keep us from experiencing the truth, from knowing real life. Philosophical speculation is fine, but where does it get you? We have to get to a place where there's no compromise, where we're making a firm decision between the real and the unreal, and empowering that decision with belief. So, you know, here's this young man who's saying, you know, all this philosophical speculation is okay, but, you know, really all it is speculation. And we have to get where there's no compromise, where we are not living in two worlds, as our, I think our lesson today did say, or something I read today was saying that you can't, oh, I think it was from Kent, that it's impossible to live in two worlds, but Jesus does tell us that. And, you know, so you either have to have one or the other. And that's what these boys are figuring out. So Takis says, so we can't have it both ways. The truth is true and nothing else is true. We have to choose once and for all. There's a formless oneness just beyond the hoax. It's non-dualistic. It's perfect. And only that perfection is true. We've both had lovely glimpses of it. But there must be a way to remove the barriers to it and experience it on a permanent basis. Oh, now we're on to something. Now I can live in the real world all the time. Oh, good. What an idea.
All reality all the time. Holy Spirit TV.
Don't touch that dial.
Really?
Same channel, same bat channel, same bat place here.
Exactly. Except, although I think the ego is batshit crazy all the time, but that's not part of its advertising. Right?
No, it's not. Okay, so Persis says, as you can see, their journeys had led them to a place where they knew that salvation, or as some called it, or enlightenment, as others called it, depended on making an uncompromising decision. Plato believed in logic, and that intellectual development would lead to self-fulfillment. But Takis and Akaros had enough experience to know enlightenment had nothing to do with individuality. Indeed, it's the relinquishment of individuality, psychologically that is, not physically, that leads to real fulfillment. That fulfillment can be found only in oneness. So it's not giving up the body, it is psychologically recognizing that we are one. So then Persa continues, remember, even though Plato's systems weren't perfect, his teachings and writings helped many people develop their minds to the point where they could make better decisions. For them, it was an important step along the way. Gary, what time did Plato live in? People are arguing about this now. People will argue about that, Persa said, but it was actually about 500 BC to about 450 BC. Gary, let me see what Wikipedia says. As a, you know, I have a infallible, you know, immortal being in my midst, and but I'm going to check Wikipedia instead. So, after a short delay.
Of course, the irony of that is here we have two people reading from the work of another person who has been visited by two other people that are reminding us that they aren't people, and neither is the author, and neither are the people that are reading the author's work, and neither are the people that are being discussed in the author's work that we're realizing that they're not people either. So, interesting.
Huh? What?
No, what?
It just is one of those.
What irony, huh?
Oh yeah, what are those dolls that you open one and then there's another one and you open it and it's another
Russian
one
dolls?
And you open those Russian dolls, yeah. Matryoshka, I think they're called or something.
Right.
That's what it's like. So we're just peeling away the layers. Okay, so Gary says, let me see what Wikipedia says. After a short delay, one of the things it says is the exact time and place of Plato's birth are unknown, but it is certain that he belonged to an aristocratic and influential family. Artin, let's just say that he didn't have to work for a living. Gary, wasn't Plato the first one to talk about Atlantis? Persa, yes, he heard it from Socrates and brought it up later in the dialogue he wrote called Timaeus. He wrote it as though an Egyptian named Solon was telling it to someone named Critias. That doesn't matter. But what the dialogue said was true. There was indeed an Atlantis in the dream, and the people who came together at Plato's Academy also had been together there. That's why Socrates remembered it. He lived there, as did his student Plato and Plato's student Aristotle, along with Takis and Akaros. They all knew each other at the time of Atlantis. Plotinus, a student of Plato's writings a couple of hundred years after Plato's time, was also there. As you may recall, Plotinus was the one who came up with the idea that the good, Plato's source, was one. Gary, yeah, the good is one. Boy, those guys had some pretty cool lifetimes. Artin, sometimes they were good times and sometimes they weren't. That's the nature of the dualistic dream. Atlantis ended in violence and tragedy. Not such a cool lifetime after all. But today are the Canary Islands, which our dear friend Heidi lives, which you'd like, by the way, because they're similar to Hawaii, are parts of the remnants of Atlantis. But some of the remnants extend all the way to the Bermuda Triangle. Plato wrote that Atlantis was out beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which would today would mean beyond the Strait of Gibraltar. Gary, and what exactly happened to Atlantis? Artin, although Atlantis was an extremely intelligent society, originally founded by your ancestors who were not from this planet, they made the same mistake your civilization is making today. Despite there being a very spiritual and sophisticated minority, the majority chose the duality of the physical or materialistic instead of the pure non-duality of spirit. Remember, just because beings are intelligent and technologically advanced, it doesn't necessarily mean they're spiritually advanced. Duh. I mean, look at us. Look at this world.
What a great reminder that, you know, we just look at, you turn on the news, you know, and whether it's on your laptop or your TV or your radio or newspapers, for those who still, you know, the pre-wear, you know, it's like, it's all the same stuff. You know, it's just reminders that yeah, sure, there's examples of people doing kind-hearted and altruistic things and wonderful activism that's going on. And why wouldn't we do that? But at the same time, there's all this nutso stuff that seems to, like, what, you know, I mean, and it seems to get more and more outlandish all the time. And yet maybe it's just a metaphor for how the more we look at their ego, honestly, the more insane we realize it is. The more we realize what a desert, a desolate, you know, barren, unwelcoming, uninhabitable landscape in the mind the ego's turf really is, you know. And it's just I think, a great reminder that, you know, we can choose again against as this says here, the duality of the physical or materialistic instead of the pure non-duality of spirit. One of the things that there's something that you said read in the last page I thought was pretty interesting too. So if I can find it, well, maybe it'll come across again. So anyway, but yeah, do you want to continue reading or should I go on or?
Sure, I'll continue reading. And this whole idea of Atlantis, and, you know, early on, back in my early teens, I did read a lot of Edgar Cayce because, you know, people pointed out to me that they thought that I was a reincarnated Edgar Cayce. I don't know how possible that could be, or I don't have any memory of that. But apparently at the time I did, and had a lot of, you know, insights into things that people were really surprised about. But anyway, Atlantis was one of the things that Edgar Cayce was really in touch with. And, the whole idea of that being, you know, such a wonderful civilization. And yet people were just as stupid as they are now. I mean, you could point, you know, in 100,000 years when, you know, things have switched and we look back on this society and say, wow, you know, people went to the moon and, you know, they built satellites that went around the earth and they had all this wonderful technology. And yet, look, they destroyed themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, nuclear war or whatever, you know, just because you have great technology and intellect doesn't mean that you are safe in any way at all, because those are all the laws of the ego. None of it has anything to do with God. This is all just a way of putting the magic medicine in the pill or the magic value in the dollar. You know, really putting any value or magic into the world is the same thing. It is, you know, so remember, just because beings are intelligent and technologically advanced doesn't necessarily mean they're spiritually advanced. Obviously not. All right, so Gary says, just because they're intelligent, it doesn't necessarily make them smart either. I could name a few PhDs I met who use intelligent-sounding words, but they're not very, bright, like Einstein. I like the Einstein quote. The difference between stupidity and genius is that genius has its limits. I love that.
That's good. There, somehow that reminds me of an anecdote. I made a recording, which I haven't posted to my websites yet, but of a friend named Mark who actually worked with a very well-known physicist. He's not one of the top names, but kind of in the, a name that you may have run across, who very, very brilliant and actually was responsible for helping birth a lot of modern quantum mechanics and physics. They actually, anyway, this friend of mine, Mark, was telling me this story about how he got to be good friends with him when he was alive and actually lived with him, because of some logistical circumstances for a short while or close to him. Anyway, became very familiar with this fellow and his work. And he was attending an award event one evening that was in his honor, this physicist. What transpired was that some of the other physicists were standing up and apparently misquoting and misstating some of his work. And what happened was, the guy who was being honored, didn't make a big deal. He didn't correct the errors, the technical errors that were made, and not just a few of them, maybe just one or two or something. Anyway, I don't recall the exact gist of it. But what impressed me was that rather than, making a point of being right, he decided and shared with my friend Mark afterwards that the reason he didn't speak up during the presentation is it would have been embarrassing and divisive and would have led to more conflict rather than more harmony. And he said, that wasn't the right place and time for making those corrections. So that's why he didn't, And I was just thinking, how many people would have that presence of mind and that true gentle strength to recognize that it's not about him, it's really about the shared interest that really, which in this particular situation was for people to enjoy the evening and not make a fuss. And he really didn't make a fuss about the honor that he was receiving. He was just very gracious and it impressed me that, he rather than pointing out the errors, which he had every opportunity to do, and he was the authority that, would have set those things right, but he thought he was more concerned that it would have been embarrassing or confrontational. It impressed me. I thought it was an interesting anecdote. So, yeah.
Very interesting. That is such a sweet tribute to his intelligence.
Yeah. And it was really kind of more emotional intelligence, or EQ, as I've heard it sometimes, abbreviated as, or emotional quotient kind of thing, instead of intelligence quotient, that is really kind of a reflection of the, listening to the counsel for kindness that we always have. We're always informed of choices in our mind that lead to kinder and gentler outcomes. And it just, it's important to just watch ourselves when we don't go that way and forgive ourselves and just say, okay, that didn't work very well, did it? Now I, rather than condemning ourselves, just say, now I can make a better choice next time. Yeah. And remember to do that.
That's it. Yeah. So you want to read?
Sure. Artin says, unfortunate but true in the illusory sense of the words. In any case, we're not going to give you a big song and dance about Atlantis. The point about it is, and this is also the point of this series of visits, that the majority of people find it impossible to stick with non-dualism, especially pure non-dualism. You even see it today with A Course in Miracles. It seems that people will do anything to not stick to the message, even though they'd be happier if they did. For them, this is a reminder, a tap on the shoulder. Tap, 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 tap. I'm tapping my own shoulder. So, when it comes to Atlantis, the beings in power made a form of free energy that was limitless and could have been used for good. Instead, a deranged group of people found a way to make it into a weapon. They thought it would shift all the power to them. Military parade, anyone? Gary, You mean like we did with nuclear energy? Persa, yes. Instead of using it for good, people used it to further prove the insanity of the species. It was used to make weapons that could destroy the planet and still could today. Gary, are you making your prediction? Persa, no. We're not going to make predictions right now, except for this one, and it's the same thing we said to you back in the 90s. The ego's script in the future will be more of the same, except it will be bigger, faster, and scarier. It has to be bigger. That's what the ego craves. It has to seem more important than what's come before, so you'll be tricked into believing it. Without your belief, the ego is nothing. So watching these sci-fi extravaganzas with all the special effects, and then just watching the so-called reality on the news and seeing what appears to be the escalation of insanity, it's like, well, okay, there's no order of difficulty in miracles, and there's no order of difficulty in insanity, because a dream is still a dream is still a dream, right? So anyway, without your belief, the ego is nothing. The difference between most people and people like J and B, even in Plato's time when they were Icaros and Takas, is that they weren't taken in by appearances. They saw right through appearances, recognizing them as the hoax that they were. Atlantis was destroyed by ignorance, greed, and the resulting violence. The ego's goal is always murder. Why? Because if you can be hurt or destroyed, it means that you're a body. And if you're a body, the whole ego thought system of separation is true. Then, even when you're seemingly born again into a different body, you still think that body is you. It's a gloomy cycle that can be ended only by undoing, not by redoing. Gary, quick question before I forget. You explained the 9/11 conspiracy in the third book, how the planes that went into the towers weren't real planes with people on them, and how the buildings were imploded. Demolished is the technical term. media came out with some of the hard to dismiss facts about the 9/11 events, such as how did two planes take down three World Trade Center buildings. You know, the WT-7 in particular, you know, was not hit by a plane, but it collapsed, and they were all classic demolitions. I have a cousin who's a mechanical, a civil engineer, and when I showed him these links, he said, you know, Bruce, I used to think you were a conspiracy theorist, but now I realize, you know, these were classic demolitions. It wasn't the planes at all that took those down. They were rigged somehow, and they did find traces of thermite, which were, of course, immediately whisked away because they couldn't allow anybody to touch the remains of the towers as they were hauling it away. But apparently there were traces of thermite, which is the standard material that's used to demolish buildings, that were found on the, I think it was under the ground floor of the two towers. But anyway, another aside there. But interesting that I think, you know, the whole demolition of anything that shows that the ego is insane and how quickly it gets whisked away is just another metaphor of how, you know, the double shield of oblivion of, first, let's make a world to keep us distracted and in fear, and then secondly, let's dispose of the evidence and keep us mindless so that we don't question in a logical, sane way the reality of the events and the reality of the thought system. You know, kind of getting back to, you know, the shortcoming, if you will, of Plato's teaching is that he correctly identified that the form wasn't real, but he incorrectly suggested that the ideas behind the ego's forms were real. And, so another example, huh?
Well, and actually, when you're thinking about it, because this is a part of all of these writings that I absolutely disagree with completely. However, I do agree with the idea that, yes, there were no planes. Yes, there were no people. Yes, there were no buildings. Yes, there was no real World Trade Center. There may have been traces of thermite because we imagined them. There may have been explosions because we imagined them. There were people on those planes because we imagined them. Do you think that the people on those planes, that their families at home, don't imagine them still and miss them? Yes.
Sure, of course.
This, what this kind of talk does, which is okay if you understand the nature of the illusion and duality. But if you really believe that this world is real and true, then this whole idea that there's a conspiracy theory and that they were blown up and that people did, you know, horrible things on purpose for some political reason, that's all a part of the dream. That is not real or true. And so, you know, but there are people who use things like this to try to prove that the dream is real, to try to prove that there really were buildings who were exploded.
Sure.
To try to prove that there really were airplanes that landed in some other place instead of where they were supposed to have. This is all, that's a whole nother part of the dream, landscape that, you know, some people have gone to and other people have not. And, you know, I haven't gone to that part of the dream landscape. You know, I'm still in the part of the dream landscape where, you know, innocent people were on airplanes and terrorists, overtook those airplanes and made them crash into buildings, and the buildings were demolished for whatever reason, so that we would have something to look at, to think about, and to imagine, and to give a story to, and to make people into villains, and to make people into heroes. And this is all a part of our massive, massive delusion. So any discussion of what happened in any other part of the delusion is really just another discussion of more delusion. Does that make sense?
And it does. And I think it all harkens back to, you know, the course's reminder of what is it for. And if it's to get back to the mind and to recognize that anything that is fearful is just an attempt of the ego to try to promote the fear, and to recognize that. You know, the ego itself is the source of the fear, but it has no existence in truth. If we can use it for that, then we're using any particular situation or event for the Holy Spirit's purposes. Whereas if we're using it to promote the fear, then we obviously are playing right out of the ego's script. Right.
Exactly. And that's what I think a lot of people do with this stuff. That's the reason, you know, it's fine with me that people believe what they want, because it's fine with me that I believe what I want. But the truth is that none of this actually happened. And all Artin and Persa are doing is relaying another chapter in the script.
Exactly. And as they were quick to point out, and right from the get-go, is Artin, Persa, Gary, Cindy, Bruce, Lynn, anyone else who's listening, certainly Jesus, Buddha, and all the past lifetimes that they had as Icaros, Takas, and whoever, those are all parts of the dream script. But what the important thing is what do we do with that information? You know, if brains don't think, eyes don't see, ears don't hear, we have to use that cognitive dissonance for something. If we use it for the ego's purposes, we are plunged back into fear. But there's this awareness that we all have, this peaceful place that we took with us into the dream, that can lead us out of that insanity by recognizing, wow, I do that when I watch movies like that Blade Runner sequel the other evening. It's like, gee, this is another, no worse, no better than any other part of the insanity of this dream. But what an interesting way to watch this movie with the Holy Spirit, and saying these examples of the dialogue that was used are examples of either the ego, you know, run amok and exposing itself, which is basically saying that we're all complicit as those who have chosen the ego. So it's not like it's some foreign, some alien power that has you know, blown up these things, but it's an inside job, and the inside job is really that it's our choice for the ego, and that's really the only, I think, helpful conclusion to take from any analysis of a dream event. It's always the ego that has made us unhappy, and yet it's not a real being. And so once we learn to choose against the ego, then the whole foundation is demolished. To use some jargon from that particular event again, you know, the whole thing collapses on itself because it's a house of cards. It's really just a massive dream erected on laws of physics, laws of chemistry, laws of, you know, all the laws that we think are real are just part of this Matrix movie, this dystopian flick that we've bought into with all of its special effects and all of its massive CGI investment that is goes beyond any all the movies that have ever been made put together, you know, and exponentiated however many times you want. But I mean, it's staggering to think how much we've invested in a dream and how insanely passionately insistent our egos are for maintaining it, and then it would go to any lengths to destroy the very foundation of our ability to question the reality of this world. Well, wouldn't it? So.
Excuse me. Yes, I'm just getting over bronchitis, by the way.
Oh, so, okay.
Sometimes when I try to take a drink of something, I inhale it. So anyway, that's what just happened. Anyhow, so yeah, this whole idea of these dream scenarios, I just, you know, Bruce, I just skip through this stuff. When I'm reading, I don't care, you know, I mean, I know that it's, it, you know, there are people that are touched by this and people that are led to question by these questions and trying to figure things out. But, you know, for me, it's just another, it seems like just another part of the story and another part of the illusion that's being made up to seem like it's real. And people read this stuff and they believe it's true and they believe it's real and they use it as evidence to, you know, combat the world. And to me, you just have to take this stuff with a grain of salt.
Absolutely.
You know,
just
recognize that, you know, it's just a description of a story. It's not the truth.
Exactly.
Ever what happened.
Or an ocean of salt, you know.
Exactly.
A universe of salt.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Shall I read on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you want to read on? Okay. First of all, there weren't as many people as usual on the original planes, and one of those planes was seen landing in Minneapolis. Some of the passengers had been selected ahead of time. All of them were offered several $1 million and a place in the Witness Protection Program. Some of them were happy to take it. Others were not. Then they were convinced, through intimidation and sometimes beatings, that it would be a good idea for them to do so. Most eventually accepted, but about 20% were quietly taken away and disappeared, and I'm being polite. That was a long time ago now. A few tried to, quote, come out, unquote, so to speak, and they were disposed of. The rest were slowly but surely killed off. They thought they'd have a long, rich life, but the CIA and the powers behind the scenes wouldn't take the chance. Gary, so they're all gone now? Persa, yes. Do you remember now? Do you remember how most of the witnesses to the JFK assassination were dead within a few years? Gary, sure do. Persa, same idea. Arden, moving on. In the coming weeks, we want you to think about how uncompromising Icaros and Takas were showing themselves to be, even in the presence of a great philosopher like Plato. To them, it became the truth that was important. They decided to put their belief where belief was justified, not in appearances. And after all these years with us in the Course, you know how relentlessly uncompromising the Course is. Be well, my friend, and give our love to Cindy. She's very dedicated to the Course. That's wonderful to see. And I'm going to stop there because it kind of gets into another conversation. But I think this summarizes the last few statements here, summarizes how, again, we can use anything as it's all about purpose. It's all about the intent. We can use anything as a way to reinforce the Holy Spirit's curriculum, or we can use it to reinforce the ego's curriculum. And it's not about the form. It's never about the thought. It's really about the intention and the why of anything. And the ego's why is always about, you know, keeping us deeper into fear and appearances and and not being seen for what it is, you know, and you know, of course, states very explicitly, you know, the ego's intention is murder. It's destruction. So the fact that we've adopted by default this insane murderous thought system, All it means is that we just need to look at the insanity of that and without condemnation. And that important addition of without condemnation is really what helps us see it as not part of the identity we want. And the more we distance ourselves from that identity, the more we become kinder and gentler to ourselves and everyone else by choosing that thought system. So.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, I often wonder as I read these books, and you know, I love Gary and I love Gary's books and I love, you know, Art and Persa and everything that they say, but I often see so much of this explanation of things that are happening in the dream in these books. And, you know, I wondered about that. I wonder why in the world would they be explaining something that, you know, they're telling us has not really happened? You know, why would they be trying to give us a reason or a, you know, some idea of what really happened when they know it really didn't happen and never could have happened? Why would they be doing that? And I recognize that they're talking to the level of the reader. You know, they're talking to the level of Gary. You know, obviously Gary has an interest in this and has a belief system about this. And so they're helping him to integrate his own beliefs about what's happening by, you know, not so much agreeing with his wrong-minded idea of, you know, politics and behavior, but by just acknowledging that, you know, that's what's on people's mind. People do believe these things really happened. People do believe, you know, with, you know, a certainty that there's government conspiracies about things. People do believe with a certainty in their minds and their hearts that their neighbor is plotting to, steal their apples off their tree or, you know, take the milk from their cow. People believe that these things are going to happen and they're paranoid and afraid. And so, you know, it takes, you know, teaching to help us to come to an understanding that none of these things can happen. But, you know, for me personally, when I read about these, you know, events in any kind of a book, that's a spiritual teaching, you know, I have to say to myself, this event story is being written for people who just can't handle the truth, who can't handle the idea that none of this happened. Anything you believe has occurred has never actually occurred. And that World Trade Center has occurred in every iteration of the dream. In every iteration of the dream in some way or another. And you know, whether it's being exploded, whether it's being expanded, whether it's being given engines and taken off and going into the stratosphere and being a floating space station. You know, all of those, if I can think of it, it's in the dream somewhere. If I can imagine it, it's in the dream somewhere. And this is all that we're seeing here is a result of our imaginary thinking about what could be happening. And when we recognize that it's all imaginary, we can stop imagining and see that none of this ever happened, nor could it ever have happened. I'm under no laws but God's. And that's the law of gravity. That's the law of explosiveness. That's the law of buildings falling down. That's the law of, I mean, any law that is not a law of God is not a law. So all these things are, they're imaginary stories.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
So, you know, I understand why, you know, they put them in there, keeps people coming back, keeps people, you know, questioning and wondering. But, you know, I mean, such almost blatant misinformation, you know, and if they only could, we're just saying, but of course that never really happened, only in your imagination. And maybe they do say that to him and he doesn't write it. But, you know, he could be saying it himself. Of course this never happened. It's only in my imagination. And there would be no more discussion about it because, you know, it's just like talking about, oh, you know, you hurt me in my dream last night. Let's have an argument about it. No, you never did. There never was. There's no reason to talk about it. Anyway, that's my opinion about that. So am I reading now?
Sure. Gary, do you mind if I ask you one more thing?
Go ahead.
Start with that.
So and this is just about the end here. So Gary says, do you mind if I ask you one more thing? But they were gone. I've come to realize that my teachers know what's best for me, even when I don't. They would return exactly when they were supposed to, and I'd ask them exactly what the Holy Spirit wanted me to, not just for me, but for whoever else the ideas may be helpful to. So, you know, this is helpful ideas to some people. And it's helpful to me because it pisses me off. And when I read it, I'm like, why am I so pissed off about, you know, these conspiracy theories being written about in, you know, a book that a lot of people are reading looking for A Course in Miracles? Why does that piss me off? Well, because I believe that it's true, and I believe that it has some sort of a capability of causing an effect.
Right.
And so, as long as I believe that, then that's the way I'm going to see it.
Yeah. So the lesson that you're getting is no different from the lesson that I get, that when I reach down into the silverware basket in the dishwasher, and my wife has put the tines of the forks or the points of the knives pointing upward, and I poke myself and realize that that's my projection. That's no different than you're recognizing that you're irritated by an interpretation of what happened at the World Trade Center. And what struck me as kind of funny a moment ago is I'd never thought about this, but what a great metaphor for the ego. World trade. We're trading one world for another, and that's the ego is the center of that idea.
Exactly.
What an interesting metaphor that it's the World Trade Center that is the, you know, we're trading the world of reality that the Holy Spirit has you know, said is our true estate, our inheritance, which we can deny, but we can't change it. And we're changing. We believe in a dream only that we've exchanged that world for lifetimes that take names such as Bruce Affection, in my case, like that, or Lynn, whatever jargon we've thrown on these little cartoon character identities that we claim to be our ourselves, but it's a lowercase s, you know. Anyway, but yeah, what an interesting observation to note that all the things that bug us and that we seem to push our buttons are exactly the perfect mathematical classroom that the Holy Spirit has a completely different translation for that's counter to the ego's interpretation that this becomes a grievance under ego's counsel, and it becomes a healing opportunity under Holy Spirit's, huh?
That's it, exactly. And it's so simple. You know, it's so simple, and Iris like that talk about world trade also. It really is, you know, very symbolic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's happening with us. I think, I guess, is that we're trading the world. Okay.
we choose our battles, but we usually choose ones that have to do with a dream instead of just choosing against all battles by being above the battleground.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we're all working on it together, aren't we, Liz?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. So later on, one gorgeous California Sunday, Cindy and I took a long day drive up and down a section of the coast. We went beach hopping and town hopping down to Huntington Beach and back up to Redondo Beach, which I call Redundant Beach for fun, Hermosa Beach and Manhattan Beach. It was one of those perfect days when everything went right. From the people to the weather to the sights and experiences, it was perfect. We felt wonderful. On the way home, we stopped in Marina Del Rey, and we found a lovely place on the ocean to have dinner. It was early, so we were lucky and got a table right on the water where we could take in the sunset. Oh, this sounds so wonderful. We ordered our food and were enjoying the view. Then, for some reason, Cindy decided to check her phone messages. As she listened to the messages, I saw the gentle smile on her face replaced with a look of horror. Cindy's stepbrother, Jeff, whom she grew up with and is very close to, had been killed in an accident. Wow. While Cindy tried to contact her dad and her stepmother, Alice, it seemed like life had stopped. It's a hopeless, gut-wrenching feeling to be confronted with the death of a loved one. Looking back on that day, it was an extreme lesson in duality. One second you're enjoying a fantastic day, the next second the ego's dream of death kicks you in the face. We did everything we could to deal with the situation, but it never feels like enough, so we did the best we could. Jeff was someone I was just getting to know. It was strange to have him go so soon because I really felt like I'd get to know him a lot better. We were both guitar players. In fact, he was probably the most sought-after guitar player in Las Vegas, and I looked forward to jamming with him. Sometime after Jeff and I met, something happened that was a joyful surprise to all of us. Jeff had read my first book and was starting to study the course. Jeff's mom, Alice, after visiting with him one day, called and emotionally expressed her gratitude to me. She had never seen her Jeff so peaceful. A mother knows her son. She knew a transformation had occurred. I was really struck by this huge lesson in duality, but not just by the negative part of it. As the weeks after Jeff's death went on, there was a tribute to him in Las Vegas that we attended. Most of the entertainment community in Vegas showed up and paid tribute by doing what they do best, performing. It was probably one of the best concerts of the year. Cindy was a featured singer, and she spoke poignantly about her and Jeff's childhood. Many of the performers present said the tribute was the best thing that ever happened to the entertainment community in Vegas. People who hadn't spoken to each other in years reunited and renewed their friendships. Others got to meet each other and become friends. There were a couple of people in Jeff's family who also hadn't spoken in years, who ended up the day hugging each other. It seemed that Jeff was still helping his friends and family, even though his body wasn't present. About a year later, I realized that the same experience I had with my parents was repeating itself with Jeff and his friends and family. Yes, we grieve, and we should. It's best to be normal when that's what's called for. But there was something else. Eventually, the pain you feel for the one you appear to have lost goes away. But the love doesn't. It will always be there. The love is real. The pain isn't. And isn't it interesting that the most real thing we have in our lives is something you can't see? You can't see love. You can't see love, and you can see love in action, but you can't see the love behind it. This is also true of the kingdom of heaven. You can't see it with the body's eyes, yet it's the most real thing that there is. We will return to a world we can't presently see, although it can be temporarily experienced, even while we appear to be here. Then a permanent experience will come where there will be only reality, an awareness of a constant state of oneness, and the only thing that is real, love, will be all that there is. So that's the end of that chapter. And, a lot of interesting stuff. And it's really, this whole idea of having a wonderful day and then finding out someone that you love has been killed is a real shocking event that really will tend to wake you up to some experience or another. But, isn't that what our everyday life is? It's a series of, I think I'm going to have a little bit of peace, and then I'm going to jolted by, whatever seems to be happening in the world that I am invested in or connected to, or that I have an identification with. And when that thing that I identify with has been messed with, changed or killed or in some way altered so that it's no longer the thing that I thought it was, how does that affect me, and how do I react to it, and how does A Course in Miracles inform me about the proper reaction, the way that I should see things, the way that, if I'm under no laws but God's, then these things that seem to happen are pretty inconsequential, because they're pointing out lots of other laws that are not even real. The law of death, the law of driving safely, the law of, not flying an airplane into a building, the law of gravity, the law of, people that I love, dying. These are all laws that I subject myself to on a daily basis in billions of ways. And, to come out to the point where I recognize that none of them really have any kind of meaning, none of this, no matter how much I want it to, means anything. Nothing I see here means anything. And if I think it does, I'm the one who gave all the meaning to it. So I'm the one who said, oh, this is important and that's not, or all these things are important or whatever it is. I'm the one who did it. And I can just as easily let that go. And this is what this course is all about, letting go of the false belief and only remembering the truth.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's that dedication to the non-duality that A Course in Miracles is leading us on to, or back to, more accurately, that is presented in very interesting ways in Gary's writings that I find really helpful, because it you know, just like these documentaries, so to speak, of written form of the lives that Jesus and Buddha had together, how it basically makes it very accessible to me and it's not to the Bruce of fiction character, it's to the decision making part of my mind as a reminder that I can, similar to what they did, go through all the trials and tribulations and looking at the grievances and the upsets and the petty jealousies and the annoyances and all the stuff that crosses our mind that in like Gary describes that, you know, a day that seemed to be wonderful and then ended in a family tragedy as most people would see that, and of course on the level of form, why wouldn't we grieve and do the appropriate things and try to be comforting to those feeling that loss, but at the same time recognizing, wow, in truth there can't be any loss, and if there is, it has to be illusory, and that's why if we keep using our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, aka Jesus of A Course in Miracles, as our criteria for decision making, we keep coming back to that choice point in the mind where there really is only one distinction that's important: is this peaceful? Is this leading to peace or away from it? And would I accuse my brother of the things I'm accusing him? In any moment, when I accuse anyone that seems to be doing something that I dislike, or saying, or thinking, or expressing something that, may be different than what I believe to be true or want to happen or whatever, if those become, between us, then that's there's a story about Bill Thetford, when two course students were arguing over what's one of the readings that they were doing meant. The story was that Bill took the book and ripped the page out of the paper, ripped the page out of the book and crumpled it up and says, "If this comes between you and your brother, it's not worth it," because it's not about the form. And what a great what better example than Plato to say, it's not the form, it's not these symbols, these walking representatives that are really replacements for the reality, placeholders that never really satisfy, that if we just see them for what they are and not condemn and just say, wow, this is a pretty desolate, empty, nothing, a whole lot of nothing going on, with apologies to Terry Lelos, it's really just a whole lot of, silly game playing that we're doing. The virtual reality movie that we find ourselves in is just an arcade game that we've set up in our mind that sometimes we win, sometimes we lose, and sometimes we have a whole bunch of that going on in the same day and we're in the same minute even. And yet if it can change, it can't be real. That's, another criteria I find really helpful. So a lot of times when I'm talking to people, either for the first time or on ongoing conversations, I'll ask, what got me into, the study of sacred geometry, of course, which Plato was, figures prominently in his being honored with the so-called discovery of the five Platonic solids. I think I touched on last week when we started this chapter, as, that he's credited with that. And yet, the awareness that was that brought me to the study of what became known as sacred geometry, and including the Platonic solids, was I wanted to know what doesn't change, what is true regardless of things that can come and go. What can be independent of time and space and be relied upon. And that's, I think, what leads us inexorably back to the pure non-duality that A Course in Miracles is such a tremendously, you know, profound example of, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really all that we're doing here is, you know, being shown a picture and making the decision, how much of this picture do I want to believe is true? And over and over and over again, we're given the choice. And you're right, you know, several times a minute. It happens, you know, my mind is just, you know, filled with opportunities for rejecting the truth and believing the lie. It's everywhere I look. And that's why all these lessons are just, you know, they're not, you know, stop seeing that now. They're saying, let's just pry a little bit back here. Let's just pull this back a little bit and look underneath the cover and see what's really there. You know, and you know, there's no, you know, we're gonna rip the blankets away and you're gonna have to see the whole thing. It really is a matter of a little at a time, as much as I can stand. And, you know, if I'm still so caught up in this world that I can't stand to see any of it ripped away, you know, a very little is going to be shown to me. I've got to have that willingness to just not be enthralled in belief of what it's showing me. I've got to, you know, understand. And the best way really that, you know, Jesus points it out to us over and over and over, you know, you don't have to look and say, oh, this cup is not real, or this table is not real, or, you know, I mean, that is, you know, helpful to get the idea, but look at your brother. Look at your brother and question, what is real about what I'm seeing here? What reflects the Christ in what I'm seeing here? Where is the Christ mind in this being that is in front of me? And that's where you're going to get the real work, because your ego is going to tell you, it's not. There's no Christ mind here. There's no loving person here. There's no divine being here. This is an animal. This is an evil creature. This is somebody who offends me. This is somebody who does things that I don't believe in. You know, this is what your ego is going to be telling you. And that's really what you have to reject. You have to reject the idea that anything about your brother can harm you. And that there is anything that your brother is capable of thinking or doing that can cause any real damage to what you are. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal does exist. There is no such thing. And so whatever they're trying to threaten you with or bring into fear in your life or bring into, and that could be anything, your doctor. You know, I go to the doctor, the doctor says, oh no, you've got bronchitis, you're sick, you've got to take these pills. You know, is that person attacking me by affirming that what I believe about my body is happening, really is happening? No, they're not attacking me. They're affirming what they believe is true about me. And I'm affirming what I believe is true about me, and I'm affirming what is true, I believe is true about them as well. And so you don't have to go so far as to saying the world is not real. All you have to do is look at your belief about your brother and your belief about yourself and then see under how many ways are you rejecting them as not being the Christ, not being the Christ mind. Because, of course, the body and the personality isn't, but the being that they truly are is. And my love and respect for that will let me put aside all those other beliefs that I have and all those other fears that I have and look only for the sameness and the things that I can connect to and the things that actually are showing me the Christ in my brother. That's what I'm looking for, not exactly. For, you know, how are you going to hurt me?
Yeah, and it's interesting that because the irony of that is that in order to get back to that, we just have to look gently at the devastation. We have to look at all the unkindnesses and the unloving thoughts that we have in order to see their unsubstantiality in truth, that those things come and go, and the things that even we put on pedestals and we idolize and have special love relationships as well as the special hate relationships, the things that push our buttons in a compelling way or an addictive way or in a way that makes us behave insanely, thinking that we lack something outside of ourselves, whether it's a person, place, thing, sex, drugs, rock and roll, anything to do with time and space or form, can be a mechanism for trickery, egoic trickery. And if we can just watch that without judgment and just say, oh, wow, I fell for that again. I thought that, was going to be the salvation because I was identified with a body. And underneath that, I was identified with a separate self, a persona that could exist apart from the perfect oneness that I can't even imagine because I've gone so far down the rabbit hole. So the way out is to remember that behind all that, there's this incredibly, infinitely kind, gentle voice that's not any kind of acoustic or physical thing. It's our inner awareness that we took with us into the dream that's just consistently saying, I opened to page 83 in the text because it just kind of reminds me of what you talked about a few moments ago, Lynn, was that, that we have to look at the craziness in order to undo it. And behind that, though, that is really the motivation for looking at the illusion without judgment is to see the reality. And so this is paragraph 8 from section 4, chapter 5 in the text. How can you who are so wholly suffer? All your past except its beauty is gone and nothing is left but a blessing. I have saved all your kindnesses and every loving thought you ever had. I have purified them of the errors that hid their light and kept them for you in their own perfect radiance. They are beyond destruction and beyond guilt. They came from the Holy Spirit within you, and we know what God creates is eternal, unchanging. you can indeed depart in peace because I have loved you as I loved myself. You go with my blessing and for my blessing. Hold it and share it that it may always be ours. I place the peace of God in your heart and in your hands to hold and share. The heart is pure to hold it, and the hands are strong to give it. We cannot lose. My judgment is as strong as the wisdom of God, in whose heart and hands we have our being. His quiet children are his blessed sons. The thoughts of God are with you.
So. Wow, that is so wonderful. And where was that again?
That's page 83 in the printed version of A Course in Miracles in the text, which is the last paragraph of section 4 in chapter 5.
Chapter 5.
It really is a lot in there. We oftentimes read that as a closing meditation in our Wednesday night online study group about a decade now. So that's a favorite, but it's just kind of a reminder that, and I think it ties into what Gary Renard's work says, that, if you just see that there's an illusion and you only go with that, wonderful Eastern, and mind, altering, idea, that's helpful, but it's not, it's a necessary but not sufficient, condition to undoing the ego, because we have to see the reality beyond it. And that's why I think, our three steps of forgiveness of reveal, release, and replace is so important, is that if we have done our work in the little willingness of revealing the ego's insanity and desolation and releasing our white knuckled grip and to see that there's nothing in our hands as it unclasps, then the true reality, is then evident beyond that, and that's the kindness and the every loving thought we ever had that is the beauty that we all share, that is impelling us onward to be devoted students of non-duality.
And that's that's the perfect thing, and it looks like we're at the end of our time. The next chapter, Siddhartha and his son, and so that'll be interesting to read as well. And I appreciate very much that you get up early and teach with me on Saturday morning, Bruce.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And I'm already up usually for quite a while, but,
me too.
Anyway, well, thanks again, Lynn, and everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
All righty. Very good. And I'm going to drop the mic and turn it over to Iris. So, once again, thank you so much, Bruce, and I'll put this recording in the folder.
Great.
All right. Bye-bye.